How are we doing? Doing okay? Excellent. So, as Ben said, my name is Tom, and I'm the lead pastor here, and we are starting a new teaching series. And for those of you who have been around for a while, you know that my brain sometimes works in strange ways. So here we go. Growing up, there was, in the time frame when I grew up, there was a somewhat bizarre fascination with quicksand and avoiding quicksand and extricating yourself from quicksand. It was the fodder of TV and movies, and there was a weird amount of conversation that happened around what you should do if you get caught in quicksand, with all sorts of expert opinions on how to best get yourself unstuck from quicksand. You would think at the height of the Cold War, we would have other stuff to worry about other than getting stuck in quicksand, but I don't know. Sometimes getting stuck is it's the foil for comedy and TV and movies. And one of, I'm gonna go out there, I'm gonna say this, maybe one of the top five comedic performances of all time, Marissa Tomei and My Cousin Vinny, right? All right, run that again and louder, please, if you can. Marissa Tomei, My Cousin Vinny, getting stuck in the mud in Alabama. Sometimes getting stuck isn't funny. It can be scary or even dangerous. This had to be my junior or senior year of high school because I was driving and we had a snow day. And why are there snow days? Because it's dangerous to drive, right? So what did I do? I got in my 1968 Mustang with rear wheel drive and decided it would be a good idea to drive across town to go see my friends. And I had a couple other buddies with me, and we're driving down Strobel Road in Trumbull. We get past the high school, and we see another one of our friends who had slid off the road and was stuck in somebody's front lawn. So being the good friends that we were, we stopped, and we're trying to help get them unstuck. As we're sitting there, we see another car coming down the road. Okay, whatever. That car's not slowing down. That car just hit the ice, and that car was heading right at us. And if there hadn't been a tree between us and that car that car hit and then bounced off of, it would have taken us out. So three cars stopped, two cars stuck, bunch of people standing around, and a police officer comes down the road. All right, now we're gonna get ourselves unstuck. This particular police officer was driving too fast for the conditions, slid in the ice, and ran into the same tree that the other people did and bounced off of. Just a bunch of stuck people. Fortunately, nobody got seriously hurt, and we were able to get ourselves moving along the way. Sometimes when we get stuck, it devolves into the worst case scenario. The soundtrack to my early marriage years was the grunge music of Seattle. Tells you something about me. Not my marriage, but about me. Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Mad Season, Alice in Chains, and of course Stone Temple Pilots. And the picture that should be going up behind me is a picture of Scott Weiland. He's the lead singer of that band, Stone Temple Pilots. They came on the scene with this album that exploded. And he had some underlying mental health issues. And this sudden fame and celebrity didn't help his issues. This song that's playing is called Flies in the Vaseline. And in it, there's a lyric that says, "Look at you, look at me, I'm going blind, I can't see, we're like flies in the Vaseline." He was writing about his descent into addiction and how he was stuck doing the same things over and over again. No matter, he wanted to stop, but he couldn't stop. And sadly, his addiction ended up taking his life. There's no shortage of ways. We can get off of that one now. Thanks. There's no shortage of ways that we can get stuck. We want to spend the fall between now and Christmas figuring out how we get unstuck. And when I think about the periods in my life when I've felt stuck, it's like Weiland was describing. It's that same day over and over again. If you're familiar with the movie Groundhog Day, no matter what you change, the end result is still the same. And that feeling of being in a rut, it can deaden you. It can make you sad. It can make you angry. But there's usually, here's my observation, my experience. There's usually one area of our lives where we're stuck. That's got us by the foot. That makes us feel like we can't move forward. And that one area, the negative consequences, the negative impact of that leaks out into the rest of our lives. And so it affects all of us. So we're going to spend the fall getting unstuck, and here's how we're going to do that. That's going to be our teaching topic. There's plenty of characters in the Bible who we see get stuck, and then through the work of God, they get unstuck. There's topics that talk about getting unstuck, and we're gonna look at those. Like Leanne said, we have the prayer space open up. So even if as I'm talking, not even if, especially if I'm talking and it stirs something up for you, go back, see Kevin or whoever happens to be back there in a given week. Tell them what's on your heart and mind, and let them pray with you and for you. During our weeks that we do groups, you're going to hear some recurring themes. We're going to be working on getting unstuck together. We're going to help each other get unstuck. What is it that would be helpful for you to know about God or experience in God that might help you get unstuck? What piece of information or knowledge about you, about yourself, would help you get unstuck? Remember, those are the two great things, our identity as we look at God and we look at ourselves. And if we can get our brains around those things, man, we begin to live the life that Jesus created for us. And we're also going to want to be really practical, right? If this is an area where I'm stuck, what's the next step? What can I do? And we're also in the process of recruiting what we're just calling unstuck coaches. We're going to ask people who have been walking with Jesus for a while, who have gone through some seasons of stuckedness, of being stuck, and they're going to volunteer to walk alongside you. Now, that person can't get you unstuck, but that person can walk with you and encourage you and support you. And somewhere along the way, they might even ask you some hard questions, right? So those are all the things that we're putting together to help us all get unstuck together. Because this is something that, whether you're in a season right now where you feel stuck, or maybe you've come out of one, and for some of us folks, it just feels like that's our existence. Like, we're just stuck, man. We're just stuck. That's my life. And that's not the life that Jesus has for you. So this morning, we are going to look at an Old Testament prophet by the name of Jonah. My friend Jonah is unfortunately an example of somebody who did not get unstuck. The first reference we see to Jonah is in the Old Testament book of 2 Kings. Jonah is a prophet, that which means he's a messenger of God. God has a message for King Jeroboam II. Through Jonah. Jonah goes to the king and he says, King, go fight this battle. No problem. God's on your side. You're going to win. Jeroboam goes and fights the battle and he wins. But here's the thing about Jeroboam Jr. He was not a good dude. He was like, actually, he's probably one of the top two or three worst kings that Israel had. And he led the entire nation astray into infidelity, into idolatry, into worshiping false gods. The prophet Amos comes along and says, Jeroboam, you won that battle, but that battle, those people are going to come back, they're going to conquer you, and it's going to get way worse than it ever was before. They're going to take your land, and they're going to take you into captivity. So we have this idea that while Jonah, God spoke through Jonah, we're kind of like questioning Jonah a little bit before we even get to the book that's named after him. The book that's named after him, we have other books named after prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, but those books are collections of their writings. The book of Jonah is about Jonah, with that couple of his writings spattered in there. So Rudy's going to be working through these slides, and I'm going to give you just kind of a high-level overview of Jonah's story, highlighting a couple of the verses. I would encourage you to go read it. It's only four chapters, the whole book, and they're not long chapters. It's maybe like two pages in your Bible. So God gives a message to Jonah. Chapter 1, right off the bat. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it because its wickedness has come before me. But Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. Nineveh's over here. Tarshish is over here. Jonah went the opposite direction as far and as fast as he could. Gets to Tarshish, finds passage on a ship, and they set for sail. Jonah, presumably exhausted from running from God, goes down below and falls asleep. While he's asleep, a storm blows up. And it's like, it's raging, and it's knocking the boat around. And the sailors are doing sailor things to try to keep the boat afloat and keep everybody safe. But it's not working. It says in the text, but the sailors are able to discern that Jonah was the cause of their problems. So they go wake Jonah up, and they're like, dude, who are you, and what did you do that's putting all of our lives at risk? So he says this. He answered, I am a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord of the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. This terrified them, and they asked, what have you done? This is a parenthetical note in the text. They knew he was running away from the Lord because he had already told them so. So Dr. Tim Mackey kind of points out, this whole book is pretty satirical, and there's comedy splattered throughout it if you're paying attention. Here's Jonah, says, I'm a Hebrew. The God who I worship, where I just read it, made the sea and the dry land. He made this, but I think I can run away from him and get away from him by going to the water. Jonah, there's some flaws in Jonah's thinking. We're supposed to kind of laugh at him in that. So they wake him up. Jonah says, yeah, you know what? You just got to throw me overboard. And they're like, we don't want your blood. The sailors like, we don't want your blood on our hands. So they go about doing every other sailor thing they know to do. And they're in trouble. The ship is in trouble. So finally they say, these are a bunch of probably pagan sailors, maybe worshiping other gods, maybe not worshiping any god at all. They pray to Jonah's God, God forgive us. They throw him overboard, the sea's calm, and they're fine. And the text says that they go on to worship and sacrifice to Yahweh, to God. So as a result of that, they come to know God. The text says, now, the Lord provided a huge fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. So I'm going to push pause here for a second. I don't know if you guys were here for our study in Revelation, we talked about the idea of presuppositions, right? Those are the ideas that we bring to the Bible, just in general, what we assume to be true and not true. And there are two big ones, I think, that can get us stuck in this text. And the first one is that Jonah is a Sunday school story. It's made for a felt board for little kids. Jonah's the hero. That's it. That's the story. Maybe a little about God being angry in there, but that's it. That is an overly simplistic view of this book. This book is an incredibly sophisticated piece of writing. One of maybe the most sophisticated pieces of writing in the entire Bible. It is not something to be relegated to a Sunday school class. The other end of that, maybe not the other end, but another thing I think we could get stuck in is that our inner cynic comes up. 3 days and three nights in a fish, right? That's not even possible. So here's the thing. There's plenty of scholarly work that holds up the book of Jonah as historical, like this actually happened. There's an equal amount of scholarly work that says this is a parable or it's allegorical. Both of those come together and come to the same conclusion about the meaning of the book of Jonah, which we're going to get to in a second. So whether this is historical and Jonah actually spent 3 days in that fish, or that's a metaphor and it's an allegory for us to dig into, doesn't really matter, right? We need to kind of rid ourselves of the false dichotomy of everything that we read in Scripture is historical, because some of it's not. Jesus taught in parables, right? It's a false dichotomy between it's either all historical or we got to throw the whole thing away. Unpause. Okay, so now we're moving back on. So Jonah in the belly of the great fish, he doesn't really apologize, but what he does do is he acknowledges who God is. Right? He doesn't say, I'm sorry, I ran away, that was silly, I shouldn't have done it, whatever. This is what he says. Those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love for them. But I, with shouts of grateful praise, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. I will say, this is salvation comes from the Lord. And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Then the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time. Go to the city of Nineveh and proclaim to it the message I have for you. Jonah obeyed the word of the Lord and went to Nineveh. a little bit more of the comedy. Like the in Hebrew, the word for vomit actually sounds like somebody vomiting. It's onomatopoeic in that sense. It's a really, like I said, it's a really sophisticated piece of writing. But Jonah says salvation comes from the Lord. And the meaning of the book of Jonah is that the Lord wants his salvation for all of his creation. Not just the Hebrews, not just Jonah, but the people of Nineveh who were fighting against his people. So Jonah, this time Jonah listens and he goes to Nineveh. Nineveh is a huge city. Nineveh is also part of the Assyrian Empire, and the Assyrians were infamous for their brutality. Wow. Yikes. Where's that water? Thank you. They were infamous for their, I'm done now, for their brutality. Just torture, rape, pillage, plunder, all of it. People were terrified of them. God tells Jonah to go into this huge city and tell them that he's got a word for him. So Jonah makes it a third of the way into the city. In the original language, he delivers a five-word sermon. I don't know how many words it gets translated to in English. I'm going to read it to you here in a second. I don't have it in here. Is it up on the slide? Yeah, that's it. That's all we know of what he preached in the city. 40 days more, and Nineveh will be overthrown. As a result of that, everybody from the king, and the text actually says the cattle, repented. The whole city repented. 40 days more, Nineveh be no more. You guys wish that was my sermon, right? Five words, and we're out. So Jonah pulls out of the city. And Jonah is ticked off, man. He is angry. He is angry. And this is, we learn why Jonah ran in the first place. This is Jonah in response to God, all the people in Nineveh repenting. But to Jonah, this seemed very wrong, and he became angry and he prayed to the Lord. Isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at my home? This is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew that you are gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live. God shows compassion and grace to a people who don't deserve it, and it makes Jonah angry, so angry that he wants to die. The remainder of the text is just like half a chapter. God and Jonah have another exchange, and the text ends with Jonah just saying, just let me die. That's Jonah's legacy. Angry, rebellious, praying for death. Because, why? Because God did what he said he would do. Jonah used that description, gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger, abounding in love. That's the part of the name that God gives himself when he's talking to Moses on Mount Sinai. Gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in love. And that made Jonah mad. So Jonah was stuck in lots of ways, right? He was stuck in running from things. I don't know about you guys, but I have people in my life who that's their MO. They feel like if they can get to a different place, they can start over. But you know what the thing about running is? You know, it's the same no matter where you go. You, me, if I run, it's me. He was stuck in a fish for a while. He was stuck in his anger. He was stuck in self-righteousness. He was stuck in judgment. He was stuck in vengeance. You know, we don't know, but maybe there was a certain amount of pain and trauma in there. We don't know if his family might have been hurt or injured by the Ninevites, but we know his countrymen were. Jonah was stuck in a lot of different ways, but I think the ways that he is stuck in are symptomatic of like that. Remember I said there's one thing? There's typically one area where we get stuck and it leaks into everything else and it creates kind of that other mess. And I think Jonah was angry because God didn't do what Jonah would have done if he were God. Let me say that again. Jonah was angry because God didn't do what Jonah would have done if Jonah were God. Okay, now just think about that and put your name in there in place of Jonah's. Because I've been in that situation more than once. And not to pull you all down with me, but you're coming. Tom was mad at God because God didn't do what Tom would have done if he were God. And thank goodness for that. I would make a terrible, terrible God. I was talking to our friend Dr. Mike this week, and we were having a conversation about this. And he said, it sounds like Jonah's issue was surrender. He didn't want to surrender to God. That's the foundational point of Jonah's being stuck. Jonah did what God asked him to do eventually. And the people repented, and other people were blessed because of it. But Jonah just walked away all angry and bitter. And that's how we remember Jonah. I wonder what the rest of Jonah's existence was like. I wonder what the rest of Jonah's existence might have been like if he stayed in Nineveh and like maybe discipled some of those people, walked with them in the early days of their faith. What stories he might have heard about transformation being caused by God. What other words from God he might have had for the people of Nineveh. I think he missed out on an incredible amount. But I would suggest to you that this is like the foundational issue when it comes to getting stuck. Is are we willing to surrender it all to Jesus? One of the many beautiful things about Jesus is he does not ask us to do anything that he hasn't done. The night before he died in the Garden of Gethsemane, he prays to his Father. He says, take this cup from me, meaning, Lord, Father, I really don't want to be beaten, tortured, killed, hung on a cross. However, not my will, but yours be done. So maybe you have a big heart, and maybe you're okay with God loving your enemies. But what are the areas where you get hung up? What are the areas where you want God to do what you would do if you were God? Are you all right with God's sexual ethic? Are you all right with God's view of pride? How about the upside-down view that God has of money, where he says, give it away and you'll be rich? Not necessarily materially, but you'll be rich. What about vengeance? You okay giving that to God, or you want a little bit of that for yourself? We all have our things, right? So here's the deal. There's the surrender where we like realize like, oh my gosh, I need Jesus. And we surrender the fact that we can make it without him. But then every day after that, we have to surrender those things that we want to take control of, that we feel like we would do a better job than God did. That's the first step to getting unstuck, but that's like a foundational ongoing step of getting unstuck. Let's pray. Jesus, we thank you for your example that even in the face of unimaginable pain and suffering, you still said, not my will, but yours be done. We thank you that your will for us is to be unstuck, to live a life of wholeness and fullness that can only be found in you. So God, as we look ahead to the coming weeks and months, we ask that you would do a work in us, those places where we're stuck. God, whether there be relational or financial or physical or emotional or fear of missing out, or if we're just actually caught in a broken system, Lord, would you show us our next step? Would you reveal yourself to us? Show us those pieces of us that we need to surrender, and then do the things that only you can do to get us unstuck. We love you, Jesus. Thank you.